may be seated.
May it please the court, my name is James Hunley, and I represent Mr. Anthony and others in this claim. Brooke Hunley is co-counsel with me. This was a case that was originally filed in the circuit court for the city of Portsmouth. It was removed to the federal district court. It was remanded when we filed a motion to remand, and briefs were filed and considered, and the case was remanded to the state court. At that time, the state court heard pretty much the same argument, read the same briefs substantially, and decided that the federal court did not have it right, that this case should be dismissed. And they dismissed it on the basis that Section 301 of the LMRA preempted the plaintiff's claims. The defendants had filed demurrers other than the one that was finally acted on that were dismissed. Since this case is coming to this court on appeal of the granting of the demurrer, then the court will hear de novo. And as we have said so many times and read so many cases, a demurrer admits the truth of all properly pleaded material facts and all reasonable factual inferences fairly and justly drawn from the facts alleged must be considered in aid of the pleading. In this particular case, the essential allegations were a false representation of a material fact made intentionally and knowingly with the intent to mislead the plaintiffs, reliance by the parties upon the misrepresentations, and that they were damaged as a result of that misrepresentation and reliance. It was also alleged that there were negligent misrepresentations as well as intentional ones. What the plaintiffs did not allege in this case was that there was a violation of a collective bargaining agreement, or that Verizon had no right to declare a surplus, or that the union breached their duty of fair representation, or that the plaintiff's jobs were in jeopardy under the surplus employer provision. Those are things we did not allege. We alleged what we think is a tort action. When the case came to us, it came to us in a way that on June 15th, the plaintiffs were told, your job is in serious jeopardy. You'd better sign this document right now, and that was an enhancement program or payment. Sign that now, or else you're going to lose these benefits. And they gave them 24 hours to make the decision. So they had one of the plaintiffs was in the hospital. One was his wife was delivering babies, but they had to come back with a decision the following day. So they made the decision to accept the enhancement. They later...
What evidence would have to be put on to prove that plaintiffs' jobs were not in serious jeopardy?
Well, I think at this point that we know that they were not in serious jeopardy because the defendants appeared at a judicial hearing, what we would call a judicial hearing, before the Virginia Employment Commission, and said that the jobs were not in jeopardy. These folks, after they were dismissed, went to the Virginia Employment Commission and said, look, we'd like to get our benefits. Verizon shows up and says, hey, you're not entitled to any benefits because you voluntarily quit your job. And the Virginia Employment Commission ruled they did not intentionally give up their jobs. We think that is... That's pretty clear evidence when they show up and make the admission before a judicial body that the jobs were never in jeopardy. That they told our people the night before that their jobs were in serious jeopardy. So that's the evidence we intend to present to show that the job, one bit of the evidence we intend to show that the jobs were not in jeopardy.
Let me follow up on that. How are you going to show that the jobs are not in jeopardy? Are you not going to have to look at the contract, the collective bargaining agreement, and the other documents to determine what the circumstances of the layoffs were, what the levels of seniority were, how the layoffs would take place? Wouldn't you have to look at all of that to determine if their jobs either were or were not in jeopardy?
Well, I don't think that we would have to look at that. And I say that, what we're here on our plea. We're saying that, hey, you misrepresented things to us. We relied on it. That is what we're here on today. Now, if we have to go, I don't know that it's necessary to go into our proof today, but what the additional fact, other than the admission before the Employment Commission, is when these people were fired or lost their job or terminated, I guess would be the best word, within a month or 2 months after they signed this document, Verizon hired 80-some employees to come in and take the very jobs that these people had. And so we don't, there's no provision in the collective bargaining agreement that deals with fraudulent or misrepresentations that I'm aware of.
But I'm just trying to understand, and I understand you're at the demur stage, but the collective bargaining agreement governs all of the relationships between the company, the union, and the employees, it's specifically governing issues of layoff and rehire and who gets laid off first, those types of things. So how would you ever determine a question of misrepresentation of a fact without interpreting that contract, or and I think how would you ever interpret reasonable reliance?
Well, first of all, I don't think that the contract or the CBA comes into play in this particular case. I think these people were done wrong. It was a tort action, is what we have alleged in these things. That's what we think. We can prove. There are several cases that maybe I can in this particular case. In the first one that I'd like to cite to you, and of course we don't feel that we think that our claim is independent of the CBA, and that it would not require the court to interpret it in any way. We think it's a totally different type of action. In Caterpillar versus Williams, there were several employers or employees who brought an action in state court against their former employers for breach of individual contracts. They had been workers who were covered by the CBA, and they were elevated in their position to management. And
so were they not saying about the allegations made to them when they were managers?
I'm sorry.
Were they not making a claim about representations made to them when they were not covered by the collective bargaining agreement?
Well, they were. But I think the important comment that was made in that case was that the presence of the federal question jurisdiction is governed by the well-pleaded complaint rule. We feel like we have pled a proper tort action through the allegations that I've just mentioned to you. We didn't ask that the CBA be interpreted. We didn't ask that the CBA in any way be involved. In fact, in one of the cases that we've cited, Harless versus CSX, in that particular case, the gentleman was, his representative was filing suit because they said that he was being discriminated against because of his age or whatever, and he goes to the federal court. They remove it to the federal court. The federal court says, we're going to dismiss your case, but you can amend. So they allowed him to amend. He still didn't get it right. They allowed him to amend again. Finally, he alleged a tort action or some action not involved with the CBA, and they said, okay, now you can go back. After about the third try, they gave them so many bites at the apple. Once there was an action for a case that was pleaded that was independent of the CBA, then they sent it back and said, you can now try your case. But,
Mr. Hunt,
yes.
I'd like to address something with you to demonstrate what this case is not about today. In this case, the federal district judge found that there was preemption. That's because there was not preemption, and remanded it. And the reason why she had to do that was because if there wasn't, there's no federal question.
Right.
Correct. But it came back to the state trial judge, and the state trial judge does have the right to revisit that question under federal decisions. But the having been remanded, the trial judge doesn't have the right to dismiss the case if there is preemption. The trial judge has the duty to try the case because of concurrent jurisdiction, and the duty to try the case applying federal law, including what modicum of federal common law has developed around Section 301. The dilemma, however, is that there's no argument in this case that the court erred in dismissing the case after finding it was preempted. And so, consequently, the way I look at this case, and if you have any other view of it, I'd like to hear it, you're stuck with your assignment of error, and in order to get this case tried, you have to demonstrate that it's not preempted. Did you follow all that?
Yes.
Right. So you can't now allege that you should have kept the case and tried it under federal law, because that's not an argument that's been made.
Right.
So we understand that's what we're focusing on. You have to demonstrate in order to prevail here that this is not preempted.
Your Honor, this case is, to me, a very narrow, simple issue. These people were deceived. They relied on the deception. There's nothing that they have never said the CBA protects us from this. We were not protected the way we should have been. They said, look, you have misrepresented this entire thing.
Right, I understand your claim, but the properly preserved, you would have been entitled to a trial based on federal law in the state court, even if it's preempted. But that's not before us, and that's why I make sure that you have any argument you want to make about whether it is or it's not.
Well, Your Honor, I've always thought that the case, from the time that it came into our office, was a tort case, not having anything to do with the collective bargaining agreement.
Right.
So they say you have to prove the you're going to have to interpret the collective bargaining agreement. There's nothing about this case. In the Hollis case, I know they finally said, Judge Hudson from the federal court said, now do you promise, talking to the plaintiff, do you promise me that CBA will never come from your lips? And he said, yes, we promise that. And I can promise you that you will never hear CBA or MOA come from these lips in this case unless...
Right. The dilemma is I'm confident it isn't going to come from your lips.
Yeah.
I'm also confident it is going to come from theirs. So the question is whether or not your tort claims necessarily have to involve an interpretation of a matter that is exclusively federal. And that's the issue, and that would be anything that has to be defined under a collective bargaining agreement. So I suspect we'll hear their side of that in just a moment.
Well, I don't think that they can. In fact, there's precedent that says that they can't introduce a federal question and have me stuck with that, that I've got to...
No, but they can demonstrate, if they can, they're certainly free to demonstrate that the interpretation of your claim involves a federal question.
Now, the case that I had cited, or the Hollis case, says the Court of Appeals has consistently held that the presence or absence of the federal question jurisdiction is governed by the well-pleaded complaint rule, which provides that federal jurisdiction exists only when a federal question is presented on the face of the complaint. And on the face of this complaint, there's no federal claim that is pursued. It's purely tort. And the I see my time is up. And sorry.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Please, the court. I'm William Furr with Wilcox and Savage. I represent Verizon. It's my pleasure to introduce Patricia Dunn with Jones Day, a member of the Washington, D.C. Bar, to make the argument.
All right.
May it please the court. I'm Sue Ann Bryant from Davis Law Group in Chesapeake, representing the Communication Workers of America District 2, and I'd like to introduce Ms. Catherine Rowe, who will be arguing the case on behalf of the union.
All right. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Patricia Dunn. I'll be dividing my time this morning with counsel for the union, Ms. Rowe, reserving 5 minutes. As I listen to counsel argue this morning that this case has nothing to do with a collective bargaining agreement, I can't help but recall the words of the trial court judge in this case, who said, while the employees deserve an A-plus for artful pleading, they simply can't, to use Judge Kale's words, quote, avoid the elephant in the room, which is a collective bargaining agreement. We wouldn't be here today but for the terms of the collective bargaining agreements between Verizon and the CWA, and I refer to those as CBAs. The employees have variously asserted that Verizon and the CWA defrauded them into accepting a collectively bargained enhanced income separation plan, and ISP, that provided under a collective bargaining agreement by misrepresenting their risk of layoff under that agreement in the context of the ISP, and by misrepresenting the CBA benefits that they would receive upon layoff. The CBA is simply unavoidable in addressing those claims. It's the elephant in the room. Indeed, the terms of the employees themselves use repeatedly in their own complaints. They don't say CBA. They certainly use contract terms like surplus, seniority, ISP, and layoffs. Those terms derive from the CBA and the memorandum of agreement creating the ISP. And those collectively bargained agreements define Verizon's and the CWA's duties and the employee's rights in the context of a surplus and ISP. Under Section 301 and over 5 decades of United States Supreme Court precedent defining the extraordinary preemptive breach of Section 301, that dependency on the CBAs makes the employee's claims federal claims from their inception that have to be addressed as a matter of federal common law, not state law. I won't delve into all those cases. We briefed them fully. But in decisions spanning over a century, from Textile Workers versus Lincoln Mills to Alice Chalmers versus Luke, the Supreme Court has made clear that Section 301 is one of those unique federal statutes that occupies the fields of labor relations and completely preempts any state law claims that fall within its reach.
Counsel,
yes.
I'd like to touch briefly on one case which carves out from that doctrine and on which the appellants rely, and that's Felix versus Lucent, and where the federal court, I believe in Oklahoma, said that defendant misunderstands the nature of plaintiff's claims. Plaintiffs do not allege that they made any misrepresentations about the terms or application of the CBA. Rather, they allege defendant lied in informing them regarding the choice between retiring under the June plan or waiting until later. Looking just at that paragraph, I thought that Felix was perfectly on point. I then looked, and your co-counsel doesn't address this in the communications workers' brief, but you indicate in your brief at page 37 that there is a distinction. And the distinction is there in Felix. Management had the discretion to determine whether and when such offers would be made, and thus the court could decide without the defendant's consent. Could decide whether the defendants concealed the truth without interpreting the CBA. To play devil's advocate, that seems like it might be a distinction without a difference. We can determine whether there was a misrepresentation of the truth in this case, without interpreting the CBA, which appears to be precisely Felix. If you would please, if you can, expand upon that sentence from your brief to convince me why we can't.
Your Honor, it's an excellent question because there are cases all over the mat on Section 301 in the federal courts dealing with this question. The distinction we were trying to make is that the misrepresentation that is alleged in this case is a misrepresentation about a risk of layoff under a collective bargaining agreement, and that is a matter that requires interpretation of contract terms governing that. The cases that were discretionary in nature are cases where the employer has made a statement about whether a plant will close, something that rests in the discretion that's not in any way restricted or covered by any CBA term, the timing of offering a buyout. Those sorts of things, a promise about what something might happen in the future, all of those are discretionary or extraneous to the technical terms of a contract. And that's the distinction we were trying to make in all from all those types of cases. In this case, if you look at the nature of what they claim to be defrauded of, it is that they claim that they were defrauded about their risk of layoff under a CBA. There is no way to make that determination without delving into the 8 single-spaced pages governing reductions in force, governing things like seniority and reductions in force, governing the steps that the parties have to take before anybody can be laid off under that contract, whether it's getting rid of contract employees, bumping people out of jobs, protecting seniority. All of those things have to be analyzed to determine whether that alleged statement was true or false. And even beyond that, in this case, we don't have just the technical CBA. We have the memorandum of agreement that created this unique EISP. And in that, there are 2 additional layoff protections that govern these employees. And those sorts of protections, including one that said that there could be no layoffs between July, the first time people could leave under the ISP, and later in the year when the next phase would go, that layoff protection has to be interpreted to see whether the allegation they made that Verizon and the CWA told them they'd be laid off in August, in the middle of that phrase, is true or false. Any way you look, when you deal with job security under a collectively bargained arrangement, it is going to require interpretation of those contract terms. And that's just the explicit contract provisions that would require interpretation to assess the truth or falsity and the legitimacy of the reliance in this case. As the Supreme Court in Alice Chalmers versus Luke made clear as well, collective bargaining agreements include and implied obligations to deal fairly with the employees covered by that contract. And it rejected the lower court's effort to limit it explicitly, as counsel said, to a contract violation. That's the analysis of 301 preemption goes deeper than a mere contract violation.
But counsel, it seems even simpler than that to me. Going back to what Justice Powell was saying initially, how can you prove plaintiff's jobs were not in serious jeopardy without showing that there was not an employee surplus? And you have to go to the CBA to prove that.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. Whether there was a surplus and what that meant.
Right.
12,000-person surplus, does that mean that all 12,000 jobs are eliminated? It has to be analyzed about how these parties deal with the surplus. That's exactly right. And what that surplus triggers under the collective bargaining agreement, which is what Judge Kales held twice on this question.
Counsel, let me ask you this question. In their complaint, however, what they said in paragraph 5 was the plaintiff was told that they'd have to make a decision by June 16th whether to accept the EISP or be terminated in August 2010. That doesn't sound like risk of termination. It sounds like they're going to be terminated. Isn't that their claim, then, that there was a misrepresentation that they were going to be terminated in August?
I believe that's part of their statement.
So why do we care whether there was a surplus or not if they're told they're going to be fired?
Well, because the allegation here is their risk of layoff, not necessarily that they would be. They were alleged that was their risk, that if they didn't take this, the chances were they were going to be laid off or they would be laid off.
You're reading risk into that where I don't see it. I see they're going to be terminated.
Your Honor, I read risk into the briefs that they filed and couch that as the nature of the representation since filing that complaint. I just wanted to go back briefly to the implied duties under contract, because I think it gives some context in this case. The CBA is not state law, are the source of the employee's rights in the context of this EISP, their right to make a voluntary decision to accept this, their right to have adequate time and adequate information to consider the choice, the right to enforce the seniority rights under the contract, the right to enforce the layoff protections, and the right to be treated fairly. The CBA is not state law, defined Verizon's and the CWA's express and implied duties, as I mentioned a moment ago, and that includes their duty to treat employees fairly. I want to just also address the question about that Justice, you raised earlier, the about concurrent jurisdiction in the state court and the state court's dismissal of this case. Under Section 301, there's a strict six-month statute of limitations governing claims arising under Section 301. So not only in this case, the claims, had they proceeded as Section 301 claims in concurrent jurisdiction in state court, they would have been preempted under that six-month rule under Del Castello.
Yeah, but they would have been beyond the statute of limitations, is what you mean.
Yes.
Yeah, I've actually seen that. The reason why I raised it is that it would have been an issue if it had been preserved. But it's not even an issue.
It's not even an issue. And I need to defer my time to counsel for the union. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, Catherine Alexandra Rowe for Communications Workers of America, who is a co-appellee in this case. Very briefly, I wanted to describe why we agree with Verizon that this claim is dependent on the collective bargaining agreement and interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement, but we also believe that the circuit court's decision must be affirmed because the plaintiff fails to even satisfy the state law claim part of the preemption analysis. So it is not independent, but there's also no real allegation of a misrepresentation. The plaintiffs say it in their reply brief. They say that the sole basis of this claim is the alleged statement that their jobs were in serious jeopardy. This is a statement of a prediction of potential risk in the future. And under these circumstances...
Well, on demur, aren't we just looking at the complaint?
Correct.
We're not looking at what the language of the briefs may say. Isn't that right?
Right.
You have to see whether the complaint... You're speaking about the sufficiency of the allegations in the complaint to prove a state tort claim. Isn't that all we can look at?
Yes. And in the complaint, they allege that they were told that their jobs were in serious jeopardy 24 hours before the due date on this offer. So still, under the offer, if at least 12,000 people took the offer, there would be no layoffs for 12 months. So no one knew at that point what might happen. 12,000 people still could have taken the offer, in which case there would be no layoffs for 12 months. So this was an offer. There was a very high stakes, but it was made under conditions where there were great uncertainties, because those were the conditions that the collectively bargained memorandum of agreement set up. They set up this condition, admittedly, somewhat of a gamble, very, very tough decision. But this statement, your jobs are in serious jeopardy, made 24 hours before they had to make a decision on that offer, is simply a speculation that is very logical in the context of the offer. It's not a statement, it's not a lie, it's an opinion. And again, had 12,000 people taken that offer within that time, contractually there could have been no layoffs for 12 months. So the point about preemption here is that the Supreme Court says to escape 301 preemption, you have to have an independent state law claim. And what we're saying is that not only is this not independent, it's not a state law claim. At most, what they have is an argument perhaps that Verizon didn't really have a lack of work, therefore it was not allowed to declare a surplus. And that, to us, and as I explained in the brief, that's actually something we're somewhat familiar with. That's a contract issue. That's something we go and we say, hey, you can't declare a surplus. There's still work to be done here. We are familiar with that. But that's a contract question. That's not a false misrepresentation question.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. You used all your time. Court will be adjourned until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.